is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about everything from pen names to plot lines to penicillin. Everything will be on the table, because everything has to be on the table when you are writing. The only limitation can be your own ceaseless curiosity. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, book reviews, and video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And Author is funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and their yearly conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, you know, every writer, it seems, while they are beginning their career, has a day job of some kind or another. And sometimes these writers complain that their day job puts them to sleep. But today's guest, their day job, her day job, is to put you to sleep. I'm talking, of course, about Seattle's own Carol Casella, author of Oxygen and Healer. And she's with me now. Carol, welcome to Author to Author.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
How are things on Bainbridge Island?
They're good. They're rainy and cold, just like you would expect.
Perfect. Perfect writing weather. That's
exactly
what a friend of yours, Erica Bauermeister, said. She said, I love to write in the rain. It just focuses me.
Yes.
Is that true of you?
And dream of Hawaii, perhaps. But
dream of Hawaii. All right, listen, I'm going to have some questions for you today, but the first question I have for you, this does not count as one of my three. Our format here, by the way, listeners, is very simple. I ask my guest three questions, and she asks me three questions. Then we just talk and see where it goes. So I have one, but it doesn't count as one of my questions, and it's a little bit of a test. I want you to spell anesthesiologist.
Ah, okay. Well, let's see. Sometimes I have to tell you, I even get it wrong, especially when I'm typing. A-N-E-S. T-H-E-S-I-O-L-O-G-I-S-T.
Is that correct? I lost you about four letters.
I don't know.
It sounds about right.
You know,
I have
to confess
that in my efforts to promote this show today, I had to spell that word. And Word couldn't figure out what I was trying to spell. They just gave up. I botched the job completely. For our listeners who don't know, in addition to being an author of two novels, Oxygen and Healer, you are also a working anesthesiologist, and have been for how long?
Oh, gee, you're going to age me here. You know, 20 years, I think, now.
Wow. Wow.
Not quite.
And when was
not
it that
quite,
you started,
actually.
When did you start writing Oxygen?
I started writing Oxygen in about the year 2003.
Okay. All right. So I want to talk about your work as an anesthesiologist a little bit, because when I was younger man, if you had asked me, I would have said, well, they're the ones who knock you out before you have an operation, which, of course, you do. But then my three-year-old son, many years ago, my son when he was three, had a little operation on his ear. It was a cosmetic operation, essentially. But because he was three, they couldn't do a local anesthetic. They feared he would squirm too much, so they put him under. And this was a much more traumatic event for my wife and for me than I would have predicted. And, in fact, the anesthesiologist met with us beforehand. I thought, why is she meeting with us? This is strange. But then I understood why, because when we went with him and she put him under with us there, it was very strange to see, because it's not like going to sleep, is it?
It's really not.
It has a very different quality to it. And to me, not to be macabre, but it reminded me, he sort of shuddered to that restful place of death almost. That's what it felt like to me a little bit, although obviously he was still breathing. And I thought of that, Carol, when I read Oxygen, because this is what the anesthesiologist deals with to some degree every day that he or she works. That you don't bring them to death, but that possibility hovers around your work, does it not?
Well, it does. It always has to be You always have to be vigilant. That is really the motto for an anesthesiologist. See, I can't even say it, much less spell it. You need to be vigilant. Anesthesia is safe. It's for a healthy person. It's very safe, relatively. However,
right.
Anytime you invade normal physiology like that, you know, you run the risk. And if it makes you feel any better, Bill, my son Will had to have his tonsils out when he was 3, and my very dear friend was his anesthesiologist, and I was a complete basket case in the world.
Were you really?
I was. I was beside myself.
Now, that's so funny because, well, I mean, I just would assume that being so immersed in it, you would be able to calm yourself, but no, none of that was applicable when it was your own son.
No, logic doesn't apply to seeing your children go under an anesthetic.
Well, I thought about, too, with you, Carol, because I met you, and you're such a sort of obviously sensitive person. You're not someone who, in my experience of you, can just remove themselves from their feeling relationship to the world. And so I'm wondering where that person goes when you go to work. Are you able to sort of compartmentalize?
To a degree, I've been a doctor for a long time because I was an internist before I was an anesthesiologist, and now you're really going to get me to say my age. But I think it's part of the process of becoming a doctor. You really have to learn how to put your emotions aside. They're not always aside. I've certainly cried in front of patients. But when you're in the operating room in particular, that's just not the time to be emotional. And so you kind of go on to a very autopilot mode. If there is a crisis, if there is anything that becomes tense, you're thinking like a clinician. And then later you go outside and process it.
Yeah. And I, of course, as a writer, you have to be in connection with your emotional life, particularly you're not writing just... I mean, you write very emotional work, and so is it a relief to be able to have a place to go to where you can really explore that?
It is. And actually, my first book, Oxygen, which is very much about anesthesiology, was a place that I did that. It's about a woman, an anesthesiologist, who has an accident occur in the operating room while she's taking care of a child. And while that's never occurred to me, thank heavens, I couldn't have written about it, I don't think, but it's something that you always think about. Every doctor thinks about it. Every doctor worries about causing someone harm. And so that was an exercise in playing that out on the page.
Yeah. Did you ever feel like, see, I'm getting in more than 3 questions, but I can't help it.
You are.
Did you ever feel like, oh, God, I mustn't write about this. I am going to curse myself and sort of be predicting the future.
Well, of course, the beauty of writing your first book is you don't think anybody but yourself is ever going to read it. Mm. Maybe your mother someday.
Yeah, really. Okay.
So,
true.
So I kind of wrote in a flow, you know. I tried to write without analyzing it too much and just put the words down.
Yeah, good.
It still hasn't come true.
Well,
no wood to knock
I doubt it will, Carol. I doubt it will, but we shall see. So, do you have a question for me, Carol?
I have a lot of questions for you. I wish I could sort of channel everything you've learned from all the authors that you've spoken to. And you've probably been asked this before, but I'm still too curious about the answer to let it go. So having talked to so many writers, is there a common denominator that you find in their personalities that you think is almost essential to be there?
Oh, the personalities. Interesting. I mean, I've had a lot of commonalities in how they work, but in their personalities. Well, I think for sure a stick-to-itiveness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it seems so obvious, but there is a quality of patience and endurance, I think, that they all share in one form or another. And I think it's probably critical for writing. You know,
it's
just such a long time that you have to spend with any kind of book-length project. I think the other aspect is trust. try. You know, because this is interesting, but, you know, Lisa Gardner is a suspense writer. She said something very profound, I thought, which is she said the writer's job is to become comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I think, you know, everybody who writes is uncomfortable on some level because there's never an absolute right answer. You're always in search of that right answer.
Yep.
And I think that the sort of professional writers, the ones who have begun to actually have a career at and have written one book and another book and seen them published and dealt with the whole publishing readership experience and being reviewed and all that, I think that if they have one quality is they've learned to learn to accept the sort of discomfort that comes with the
mm-hmm.
job. You know, that their success, however that's measured, is really a translation of their willingness to accept what the rules of the game are, which is that there barely are any at all, you know, and to learn to deal with that. So
I guess
it's not quite
brilliant.
A personality type, because it's really, I mean, there's as many people. For instance, now here's a question for you, Carol. I'm going to bounce it back at you. You know, writers have been, you know, politics is sort of in the air these days. Writers tend to be left of center, you know, in terms of their politics, but not always. And in fact, I noticed there's a kind of a breakdown between certain genres are more conservative politically and some are more liberal politically. Now, how do you think it breaks down? What would your guess be?
Well, gosh, I'm tempted to say perhaps that romance writers might be a little more to the right. And,
correct.
Ah,
very
good. That's really interesting.
Yes, and so do suspense writers.
Oh, really?
Not always,
suspense
of course.
Writers.
Yes, they tend to lean more right. Literary writers almost always lean to the left, almost universally.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, so here's another question for you. As I said, your first book is Oxygen, and then your second book was Healer. I know you're hard at work on your third. But talk to us about the difference between when you finished that first book, now it's out, it's been reviewed, you've had the whole publishing experience, and then you're working on the second. Now, was the second one done by the time the first one came out, or were you still working on it?
No, not at all.
Okay.
The second one, I naively thought that I could finish up much faster than the first book, which is kind of, I think, the equivalent of thinking that your second pregnancy will take less than 9 months because you've done it before.
Right.
And it really reminds me of what you said Lisa Gardner said, because once your book has been published, you do have to learn to live with discomfort. You have to learn how to live with the idea that those secret thoughts that you put down on the page, trying to be as honest as you could about how you see the world, are now out there for comment by people you've never met, people you never will meet, people who don't know anything about you. And if you're at all a sensitive person, which everybody is deep down, that's going to bother you at times.
Yeah.
And even just the self-reflection that it takes, I think, to dive into the second book knowing it's going to be published. So the second book was hard for me to write, and I was working a lot on my style. I was trying to let my style evolve and learn. One thing about writing is you never master it. It's one of the best things about it, but it's also one of the most frustrating things. It constantly amazes me that you can sit down to a blank page knowing exactly what you want the image to be that you're painting, the scene that you want to be on that page. And you can write it 1,000 different ways. And 200 of those ways may be very, very good, but there's no perfect way. And so it's just something that you're constantly working at, trying to get better. And I think now that I'm in my third book, at least I've really learned to accept that and learned that you've got to enjoy the process as much as the final outcome, because that's why you do it.
It's absolutely true. I mean, it's the great reward. And also, I always feel like, in a way, aren't you learning how you write books? Because there's going to be what works for Carol is not going to be the same thing that works for me, for whatever mysterious reason. And I've always felt like I have to learn what avenues are simply probably not worth pursuing for me and what seems to be worth, where I seem to always find certain heat, you know. And
yes.
Because there is no, I mean, there's a lot of books out there, but there's no book on how Carol Casella is going to write a novel anymore
right.
than there's a book on how Bill Knauer is going to do it.
I think that's really true. It feels to me like I'm working this enormous jigsaw puzzle, or crossword puzzle, rather. And you're trying to move all these words around to get not only the scenes you want and the flow that you want and the voice that you want, but still it's got to come across to a total stranger in some logical way. Just because I see it in my head doesn't mean that it made it onto the page for the reader to see. And so you have to discover a lot about how your own mind works, how you organize such a big project. I've learned a huge amount about myself in trying to discover better ways and more efficient ways to write, just playing with different ways of bringing tools into it. You know, do I write a huge scene and then cut it back? Do I write scenes and then move them around? How do you get it organized?
Yeah. What where do you land? Are you more of a like put it all down and then cut it back, or do you start with minimalism and then sort of expand it?
Yeah, no, I write overwrite. I write a lot of detail and then I go back and cut it back and try to figure out as I learn the characters and learn the real story arc, then I try to figure out which of those details matter the most. But the main thing I've learned is that I try to write the scene that is most compelling to me in the morning when I wake up. It may not
even
be
if it's
the
out
first
of order.
Scene.
Completely.
It's better to do it that way, because if you're always for me, it may not work for anybody else. But if I try to just write in a line from beginning to end, and I wake up and today is the day I'm supposed to write about the car accident or the big fight or the murder scene or whatever else, and, you know, this is the day I didn't quite get enough coffee in me, that's not the scene I should write. On the other hand, if my husband and I had some tiff the night before, that's the perfect day to write the scene about murder.
Right. Oh, you're one of those. There are people tend to write linear, you know, in a line, but I know several writers who do it that way, who are willing to bop around the story. Interesting. All right.
The trick is you have to keep it organized on the computer or you'll drive yourself nuts because you won't be able to find what you wrote.
Yeah, well, this is true. I'm sure you have an excellent method for that. All right, do you have another question for me, Carol?
Yeah, I've got another question for you here. The digital revolution has changed so much about how we bring our lives and stories into our lives in the last 5-10 years. And it's changing, obviously, how we read, because we have e-books and we read blogs now. People read less because they're constantly in front of the Internet. So I'm wondering how you think it's changing not only how we read but how we write. Do you think it's changing how people write? In terms of what they write, the length of their scenes, do you think the fact that books are being read more electronically and that people are reading more on the Internet, which is a different kind and pace of reading, do you think it's changing how authors write?
I don't think yet it's affecting truly the book length piece yet. Mm-hmm. I don't see that having any effect yet, but I do think that the Internet and the digital revolution and evolution is getting people to write more. I think people in some ways are writing more than they've ever written before. And I think that they're getting read more than, I mean, just with blogs, with the advent of blogs and Facebook and email. I mean, there is so much written communication. It's unbelievable right now. And I know there's a great gnashing of teeth about, you know, the decline of publishing, but the fact is people are reading constantly, and they're doing it online and in books, but they're reading all the time. My sons do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways more than I did. I mean, I read a lot as a kid, but they're reading all the time, but it's in a subtly different format. And I'll tell you something else which is very interesting. I read an article in the New York Times about this professor who was complaining about his students' papers. He found them boring. He found them flat. He found them inarticulate and also grammatically, you know, iffy. But then he did this little experiment, and he went and he checked out what they were doing on their blogs, because a lot of these students had their own blogs. And he found, almost to a one, that everything they were writing in their blogs was more, although it might be about the housewives of Orange County, but it was more interesting, more energetic, more insightful, and more even more grammatically correct, because they were letting themselves explore just what they wanted to, because the forum was so open. And that's what I think the beauty of the revolution is about. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff out there, and a lot of it's pretty weak in a certain way, probably a little thin, but everybody's given themselves a chance. And people are writing and writing and writing all the time. It's just, I mean, think about just Facebook, which is a small thing, but still they're writing these posts, and they're writing back and forth to each other and writing back and forth. The written word is alive and well, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know how it's going to affect in the long run, but I love my blog. I write this daily column. That's 400 words, but I love what I have to do in 400 words. You know, there's so much to do in that format, I think. And it's been a great teacher for me in terms of my longer pieces for my book-length stuff because it's helped me learn to focus that much quicker. So I don't know how it's changing books, but I know it's making us, I just think we're even more immersed in language in certain ways than in recent years. I may stand alone in that, but I do feel, I see it around me all the time.
Yeah. So. No, I don't think you're alone. I've heard that too, and I think that's true. I worry sometimes that people no longer have the patience to wade through something that's a more lingering style of writing when people had more time to sit with a book, you know, George Eliot or something where you can take all the words you want. However,
I don't know. People are still reading, you know, Jonathan Franzen sold an awful lot. And he's a good writer, but he's a big writer, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I think if you tell a good story, however you tell it, people always want to hear a good story. We are storytellers, story listeners, and I think there will always, always be an audience for it in some way. I know there are people who are trying to sort of get around books a little bit. I was listening to some interview we did with a guy who, I think it was the guy who created CSI, actually, as a matter of fact. He was trying to create a new book that included movies, and I thought, well, that's fine, but, you know, I can watch movies anytime I want on, like, six different devices, and so it's nice to have just a book sometimes. But aside from that, I haven't seen much of a change, I have to admit. I haven't seen that much. Not yet. Not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I interviewed you back, what was it, 2 years ago? Probably 2 years ago.
I think
now.
So.
I hadn't asked this question, but I've been asking it recently, and I want to ask it to you because I didn't get a chance to ask it then. So it's kind of a half question. I want you to finish a sentence for me. Are you ready?
Okay.
If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
Oh, boy. It has taught me... This goes back very much, I think, to your first comment, what we were talking about learning about yourself, about being able to accept yourself. It has taught me that I can do more than I ever thought was possible. And it has also taught me to accept my limitations, that I will probably never write something I'm perfectly happy with. But on the other hand, I never thought that I would finally, finally become the writer I always wanted to be.
Do you feel you have become the writer you've always wanted to be?
Well, I feel very, very lucky to have now written two books and had them published, mainstream publishing. I'm thrilled about that. And to be writing a third and to really have discovered that I'll never give it up. I mean, I can't give it up now. And it had intimidated me for so many years. I think too many people are told that it's a dream that will never come true, so why even try? And going back to my question about digital publishing, one of the wonderful things about it, even if, you know, a lot of material is showing up there that could use a stronger editing hand, it's become wonderfully democratized. I mean, truly,
I
anyone can write now and publish a book and offer it out there to find other people who hear the same calling, you know, hear the world in the same way they do and share it.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. I mean, I think that they do need some. There's still a lot of books that could use more editing, and you know, just sort of that sort of eye, but. I think there's a lot of people who are getting a chance to be heard that wouldn't otherwise and are, you know, finding their careers almost through this avenue. And I think it's great. You know, I tell you honestly, I'm in the middle of writing a blog for tomorrow about how wrong I am about the future. And I heard about the artist. I said, well, that's never going to win anything at the Oscars. was wrong, and I've been wrong about so many things, so I really don't know. But it seems to me that traditional publishers will be around for a little bit longer, I think.
Yeah, they do a wonderful job.
They do indeed. So you've learned your limitations, which I guess we all have to do, don't we, at some point or another, because you can only, every time you do one thing, you don't do another. Isn't that so?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, every time you write a long sentence, you didn't write a short sentence. And so it's
exactly. And every time I think I can finish something in a week and discover it takes me a month, you know, I just don't seem to be able to learn how to write fast. I'm working on that, but not happening.
Well, but why should you, you know, if you don't? Does your editor or your agent want you to write faster?
I have a lot of books left.
Do you feel like you have a lot in you?
I do. I started kind of late, and I feel like I have a lot more books to write. And if I don't start writing faster, I'm not going to get to them.
Well, are you still a practicing anesthesiologist?
I am. Yeah, I am. But I work part-time, which helps a lot. I've got four teenagers at home. That's time-consuming.
Oh, my God. That is nuts. Well, my hat's off to you. That's great that you can find all the time and the creative energy to do it. I think that's just great. But you were probably writing back in college, too, weren't you?
I've written all my life.
Yeah.
But I wasn't very good about realizing that just because you didn't like the first draft, the second draft, you had to write 8 drafts, 9 drafts, 20 drafts before you would like it. It took me a really long time to learn to do that with fiction. I mean, I think I learned it in essay writing. I was, you know, an English major. I wrote a lot of papers. But something about my fiction, I kept thinking it was supposed to come out of me good. And unless it did, I wasn't actually destined to be a writer, whatever that means.
Right. Well, so that was a hard one for you to learn, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a little tough one for a lot of people because I think that is there almost like an embarrassment factor, like how could I have written that? Look at that.
There is.
How,
you have to
God
look
help
at it
me
and
if
say...
someone ever said that, you know. Well, we still have a few minutes left. Carol, do you have one more question on your docket?
That could be answered quickly. Let's see. I was going to talk to you about voice and how you hear the voice of your book. Just maybe say one word. Do you hear it as an accent or see it as a movie or hear someone talking to you? How do you find what you consider the distinctive voice of anything you're writing?
Well, that's a good question. I in the past, when I've written fiction in the first person, I hear the person talking.
Mm.
You know, I can, like, hear them talking. I'm writing a memoir now, which, of course, it's me writing about me and my life, but I feel a sort of, I guess almost in musical terms, I sense a sort of energy and a tempo and almost like a chord, like a key that the thing
uh-huh.
would be set in. And I think I attune myself to it because ideally I want the thing to have a coherence to it. And I will experiment a bit, but when I find that certain quality that has a wholeness to it, I usually say, okay, that's it. So now let's find that and just stay with it. But
yeah,
I keep bringing that note. Yeah, I think I do it through, yeah, I think it's more through music. And so that's sort of what I do, yeah. That's what I do. That's how I find my, and how about you? How do you find your voice for a book?
It, a little bit similar. I hear it spoken to me in my head. I'll try to visualize it as a scene, but I've discovered that playing with accents, hearing a certain character with a certain accent, even if that's not necessarily where they're from, helps me. It distinguishes that character in my mind.
Interesting. Well, I see by the clock that our time is almost up. I also see I have a caller on hold, and I'm sorry, caller, I won't be able to get to you. I would have liked to have, but we're just about out of time. Carol, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Bill. You are
good
the
luck
best
with,
interviewer.
Good luck. Well, thank you, and good luck with book three. I'm sure it'll be great.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to finishing it up and looking forward to continuing with your blogs and magazine.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Carol.
Okay. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Remember, always write what you love. When you do, you really cannot go wrong. Write every day and write what interests you most. Bye for now. We'll see you next week when our guest will be, well, the one and only Andre Buse III. Thanks again, and bye-bye.